Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for June 29, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and it's mostly politics tonight. First, we'll speak with Laura Rosen, who keeps the War and Peace blog and is also a frequent contributor to the American Prospect, and the author of a piece in the July-August issue of Mother Jones magazine about some shady goings-on in Rome, plottings of the secret team around Iran, and the rebirth of some names from the 1980s, Manuher Gurbanafar and Michael Ledeen. The ghosts have come back. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be speaking with David Feige, who is a former public defender and author of the book Indefensible, One Lawyer's Journey into the Inferno of American Justice, which has just been published by Little Brown, his story of his life as a public defender in New York City, much of it with the Bronx Defenders in the only borough on the mainland of the United States. And before we get to all that, some words about the economic headlines. First of all, a few hours ago, the Federal Reserve raised the key interest rate under its control, the so-called federal funds rate, which is the interest rate at which banks lend each other overnight cash. They raised that by a quarter point. This was the 17th consecutive decision to increase interest rates over the last year and a half. The Fed's policy setting committee meets every 6 weeks or so, so that is 17 meetings over the course of a year and a half. 2 years. I'm not doing my math properly. The statement released with the move pointed to a slowing economy that would probably reduce inflationary pressures. That slowdown would reduce inflationary pressures in the coming months. But the statement still worried that these pressures were still there and left open the possibility of further increases in interest rates. The inflation, such as it is coming from commodity prices, like pressure on copper and particularly oil, not unlike the inflation in the 1970s from wage pressures. Wages for most workers are going essentially nowhere. And leading indicators, those which forecast the direction of the economy in the coming months, are suggesting a slowing economy later in the year. The Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index has been weakening since mid-May, but the Fed is still pushing up rates instead of sitting back and inspecting its handiwork to see if it's done enough. But with a new guy there, Ben Bernanke, it seems like he has to prove his manliness to the financial markets. Last week, first-time claims for unemployment insurance rose by 4,000, following a 12,000 increase the week before. This indicator remains in a good but not great zone, suggesting moderately expanding employment. We'll get the June jobs report a week from tomorrow, and I'll have some predictions about that next week. The housing bubble looks to be losing more air, but it's not a continuous process. On Monday, the Census Bureau reported the number of new single-family houses sold rose by almost 5% in May, the second consecutive monthly gain. But the longer trend still looks to be down. Sales are about 6% below year-ago levels. Also, the new sales numbers are counted when the sales of new houses are counted when a deal closes, not when the deal is signed. So there's a lag of several months in the data. A day later, the National Association of Realtors reported that sales of existing houses were off 1% in May, following April's 2% decline. May's level was almost 7% below last year's. Conditions in the condo market are deteriorating even more quickly than the single-family market, probably because the condo market is full of speculators. In some regions like South Florida, the decline is looking even more serious. And yesterday, the Mortgage Bankers Association reported that applications for new mortgages were down 7% last week, continuing a long slide in that measure. Applications both for new loans and for refinancings were down, suggesting rough times ahead for housing. We're probably still in the early stages of this one, but housing has been one of the driving forces of the U.S. economy in recent years. So with interest rates rising and energy prices still high, losing a major source of dynamism has got to hurt. This morning, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, a division of the Commerce Department, reported that the international investment position of the U.S., that is, assets owned by Americans abroad, less assets owned by foreigners in the U.S., hit minus $2.7 trillion in 2005, a $300 billion deterioration from 2004. Every year, we keep importing more than we export and borrowing the difference abroad. The negative investment position is now almost 22% of GDP. As recently as 1999, it was just minus 8% of GDP. According to the classic theories of imperialism, big powers are supposed to be creditors, with their vassals owing them money. Over the last 20 years, though, the U.S. has rewritten this theory, going from a substantial positive position of 13% of GDP in 1980 to a small negative position in 1986, and then diving deep into the red with almost every passing year. All this cash from abroad has allowed Americans to consume more than they produce, the international equivalent of living beyond our means and selling off household assets to fund the profligacy. Over the last decade, the major bingers have been people in the upper income brackets. First, the stock market boom and then the housing boom made them feel rich and turned them from savers, which they had been in the past, into borrowers, which is what they've been in recent years. All this can't go on forever. At some point, the U.S. is going to have to suck in its gut and tighten the belt. How quickly this happens and who bears the brunt of the adjustment are big political questions that are too important to be discussed publicly when there's flag burning and gay marriage to worry about. The weekly ABC Washington Post measure of consumer attitudes rose again last week, continuing an improving trend that began 5 weeks ago. Apparently, high gas prices are losing some of their sting. But despite that, much to the frustration of the White House, the public isn't all that enthusiastic about the economy 4 years into this expansion. According to a new Bloomberg LA Times poll, 50% say the economy is doing well and 47% say it isn't, and just 19% think the economy is doing better because of Bush administration policies. Though Republicans scratch their heads over this, the reasons are pretty clear. Job creation remains subpar, and wages are barely keeping up with prices, if that. People in the upper brackets feel pretty good, but of course they're the ones hauling in all the income gains. And let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Laura Rosen. And that, a minute 12 seconds from the Sonic Youth song, What a Waste, from their new album, Rather Ripped, the voice of Kim Gordon, of course. And we're now joined on the line by Laura Rosen, who writes the War and Peace blog, which is at warandpeace.com, and also a frequent contributor to the American Prospect and other magazines, and author of a piece in the July-August issue of Mother Jones. It's that's the wrong piece of paper I'm picking up there. Some strange names from the 80s showing up again. Gorbanifar, Michael Ledeen. I almost expected Clara Starling to show up, but she's been dead for 11 years, so I guess she couldn't. But some of these guys seem almost as dead as she did. What's up with these old names from the 80s returning to life, Laura Rosen?
Hi, Doug. You know, Michael Ledeen and Harold Rode and Larry Franklin or two colleagues of his at the Pentagon who are both speak Farsi. And, you know, they were really quite interested after September 11th in urging the Bush administration to consider ways to destabilize Tehran, to essentially do regime change but without an invasion. And the recurring theme from the 80s and again among some of these folks more recently is that you could essentially kind of cultivate people in the security services and the intelligence services to have a kind of coup. And, you know, they
people within Iran, that is.
Well, right. I mean, they people like this Iran-Contra arms dealer back from the 80s named Manoucher Gorbanifar got back in touch with Ledeen, apparently, in 2001, after the September 11th attacks, when it was clear the U.S. would be, seized with planning a response to the September 11th attacks that might give Ghorbanifar an opportunity to become some kind of intelligence asset for the U.S. And he brought to a meeting in Rome, which is what I talked about, that the Pentagon officials attended, someone who he said was from the Revolutionary Guard, who said that a lot of people in the Revolutionary Guard were actually quite unhappy with the Iranian leadership, and that with a certain amount of money, they would be able to launch a kind of coup. And apparently Harold Rode, who is very knowledgeable about the media, actually studied in Iran back in the 70s before the Shah was overthrown and speaks several other languages, wrote a cable that he sent from the U.S. Embassy in Rome back to the Pentagon saying, you know, it would cost a lot of money, but, you know, here are these guys who say that regime change could happen and, you know, we could hire them. So that was kind of what I was trying to figure out what the meeting was about and what they were really, you know, going for, and that's what I found out.
Well, let's talk a bit about Ladeen, who is, as they say, a colorful character. One of my favorite quotes from him was in the run-up to the Iraq War. He said, "Every now and then the U.S. has to take a small, crappy little country and throw it against the wall just to show the world who's boss." That's the kind of world that Ladeen operates in. Tell us, give us a little capsule bio of Michael Ladeen.
Well, you know, he's really quite a kind of multifaceted character, and I've only talked to him from time to time in the past 2 years. And, I mean, on the Iran issue, his public writings and his public statements, and I know several Iranian pro-democracy activists who are quite fond of him because he really champions again and again a kind of nonviolent pro-democracy regime change in Iran. So he is on the side of human rights and democracy in Iran. And he's written again and again that achieving that wouldn't require the 82nd Airborne. It wouldn't require airstrikes. He says if, you know, the U.S. would just support the people of Iran, they would rise up and overthrow the regime. And it's hard to tell that, you know, I mean, as far as I can tell, it's hard to question someone's sincerity. I mean, he says that all the time. I mean, I know many young Iranian, you know, now Iranians who are in the States who want to start NGOs or want to do things to promote democracy in Iran, and he's quite helpful to them. He helps them find grants. He's interested in them having blogs. So, you know, it's funny because in a way maybe his history, Ladeen's history, is more radioactive than in fact what he's currently advocating for Iran. That said, you know, the run-up to the Iraq War saw some of Ladeen's allies in the neoconservative movement also saying that it wouldn't require too much military force to overthrow Saddam, that in fact, you know, Chalabi had lots of supporters in Iraq, and if we just provided them a little air assistance that they could overthrow the regime and you know, things could hum along. So it's hard to know if, you know, if they're delusional, if it would really be so easy in Iran to have regime change. A lot of the, you know, sort of more mainstream Iran experts I talked to in town think that Iran is not ripe for a revolution yet, and also that U.S. support would only make that more complicated. So,
well, now Iran has a president, relatively new president, who's fairly popular. So, where would this revolution come from?
Well, yeah, I don't pretend to be an expert on Iranian society. I've never been there. I've never tried to get a visa for there. So, you know, Iran does torture people. There are a lot of journalists I've talked to, Iranian journalists who've been put in jail because of what they write. There have been tons of newspapers closed because, you know, it is an oppressive regime. It's not North Korea and it's not Saddam Hussein. So, but, you know, the famous philosopher Ramin Jahanbegloo was just put in jail last month. You know, I don't see him guilty of, you know, the kinds, you wouldn't expect that kind of thing to happen in a legitimate country, in a country that had a popularly elected leadership. So,
yeah, well, you don't have to convince me it's a bad regime, but it does seem that there is there doesn't seem to be a vast amounts of discontent that they can play with at this point. Is the Bush administration, or at least the neoconservative portion of it, chastened by their behavior, by the results of their invasion of Iraq, or do they actually?
Not publicly.
They still have their grand plans.
I don't know if there is a grand plan. After Condoleezza Rice last month said that the U.S. would consider negotiating with Iran if Iran would suspend nuclear enrichment, several prominent neoconservatives such as Richard Perle, Michael Ladeen, Michael Rubin, all associated with the American Enterprise Institute, all, you know, said publicly and wrote articles condemning that decision and saying essentially it's appeasement and that you could never trust any agreement reached with Tehran. And, you know, they're still hoping for a regime change and for the U.S. to move towards a regime change posture. You know, one can guess that they have some sympathy in the figure of Dick Cheney and some of the Middle East advisors in that office. But it's hard to tell if Cheney is really so influential on foreign policy this term as he was the first term. It seems like Rice herself has become more pragmatic and that Rice and the State Department are more influential on foreign policy this term than Cheney perhaps and some of the Pentagon civilians.
Well, let's go back to this the cloak and dagger meeting in Rome that you opened the piece with, December 2001, a few months after the attacks in the World Trade Center. We had Ledeen and some Italian intelligence people there, but no CIA people. What were they? Why were there no CIA people there?
Well, yeah, I mean, so the CIA people at first say, well, we were left out of this on purpose because there's a CIA burn notice on Gorbanifar, the Iran-Contra arms dealer, and they say that, you know, Ledeen recognized and the Pentagon civilians recognized that if we knew about this, we would have blown up the whole, you know, we would have never allowed this meeting to take place. But the more you talk to CIA people, it's not just that they weren't invited, which they were not, but that they wouldn't have come had they been invited because they were so afraid of the whiff of Iran-Contra and they were so afraid that what might be occurring is a unauthorized intelligence activity such as the type that occurred during the Reagan administration, that they were told by Langley, by Tenet, don't go anywhere near this. We don't want anything to do with that. And the CIA station chief in Rome allegedly sent a cable to headquarters saying, I'm afraid that there might be an unauthorized intelligence activity taking place. And that document is apparently now in the hands of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, which for a time was investigating whether this Pentagon office that Rhode and Franklin worked in was doing intelligence collection, which they're not authorized to do. The chair of that committee, Pat Roberts, who's a close White House ally, has managed to kind of sabotage that investigation and has asked the Pentagon Inspector General to do an internal investigation of those alleged intelligence activities.
Well, there's been many reports that Cheney has been running as essentially his own national security and intelligence establishment, sort of aside from the official one. Is this part of that enterprise?
I don't know if Cheney or people in Cheney's office having a direct involvement in the Rome meeting. The figure in the larger White House who ultimately put an end to this back channel between the Pentagon and Gorbanifar is Stephen Hadley, who was then the Deputy National Security Advisor, who's now, of course, the National Security Advisor. So but Hadley seems to have played two roles, originally authorizing this meeting to go forward, and then ultimately having to intervene at least twice with Ledeen and the Pentagon to knock it off. In fact, the Pentagon and Ledeen met with Gorbanifar in Rome, and then Harold Rhode from the Pentagon went back to meet with Gorbanifar in June 2003 in Paris, and long after the Pentagon had been asked to stop, you know, shut this channel down. I was just going to say, I mean, I don't know if you're aware, but in this long article I did, so Gorbanifar didn't give up, and he started meeting with a congressman named Kurt Weldon, from the Republican from Pennsylvania, and Kurt Weldon has now published most of Gorbanifar's incredible claims, intelligence claims, in a book called Countdown to Terror.
Yeah, well, Weldon is an interesting character. You've got an item in your blog today about him, right?
Right. So recently Weldon has said, in fact, despite what the Iraq Survey Group, the Pentagon, the White House, and the CIA say, he says that, in fact, there probably are WMD in Iraq, and all those agencies are just haven't fully investigated. And he chaired a session of the House Armed Services Committee today where he seemed to be urging inspectors to go back in to look for unconventional weapons that he seems to believe are still there.
Now, it's hard to believe that the White House would pass up any serious evidence that these things existed.
That's what I think. And
so what's up with this Weldon character? Where's he coming
from?
You know,
he, you know, last year, I don't know if you remember, but he, Weldon, championed this Able Danger campaign. Do you remember that? He said that there was, that the Pentagon had actually figured out that Mohammed Atta was in the United States before the 9/11 attacks, and that Clinton's, you know, legalistic interpretation had prevented the Pentagon from sharing that information with the FBI. So he does take, and the Pentagon denied it, the White House denied it. So Weldon does sometimes go against the White House line on some issues he feels strongly about. I just talked to a local reporter in his district to see how it's playing there, and he's not sure if people are just thinking that Weldon's nutty or if he's sort of, you know, if people locally are not paying attention to that claim of his.
Well, I'm speaking with Laura Rosen, who writes The War and Peace, P-I-E-C-E, not the P-E-A-C-E, War and Peace blog, and is the author of a big piece in Mother Jones about some strange goings-on around Iran. Ghorbanifar is a pretty shadowy character. Tell us about him.
Ghorbanifar, who I did get to interview by phone, and it's been almost 2 years by now, he, since the 1979 revolution, he's been living in Europe. So now he lives in Nice, France, and he has the former Minister of Commerce from the Shah's time is kind of his secretary in Paris. And Ghorbanifar is still peddling intelligence information to whoever buys. And he's also some kind of arms dealer or import-exporter. I went to Paris and met with some of his milieu last year, and he was in Iraq at the time doing some unspecified deal, but I imagine Iraq has become a big market for him because everybody's arming up. But yeah, he, you know, what was most interesting about Weldon's book were that there were hundreds of pages of faxes of intelligence information from Ghorbanifar, some of it claiming that there was going to be an Iranian-backed terrorist attack in the U.S. before the 2004 presidential elections, which did not come to pass. But, you know, you can kind of get a good sense of his character by just reading some of the faxes that he produced.
Well, was he supposed to be some sort of Iranian equivalent of Chalabi?
He is... he's similar to Chalabi in that he appeals to the same type of influential American policy folks who want to advocate for regime change in Iran. He appeals to them by telling them what they want to hear and what they want to say, which is that Iran poses this threat and that, you know, he offers usually fabricated evidence of the threat and evidence of the WMD, et cetera, et cetera. He also says that he told me frankly that he told Weldon for $20 million he could, you know, bring all of the Americans who would pay that amount to Iran and basically get the kind of government in Tehran that they would like. But, you know, I've never seen evidence that Ghorbanifar has Chalabi's political ambition. I've never seen Ghorbanifar say that he wants to be president of Iran or anything like that.
Well, he's just in it for the money.
It's not just for the money. He seems to really be, I don't know, it's not just money. It's money and something else. So I think he reflects, you know, he's kind of a con artist, but he's a particularly intriguing one, and I enjoyed talking to him myself.
Well, to be a good con artist, you have to be kind of charming, don't you?
He is charming, and he,
Well, now, come into the present and do a crystal ball gazing as well. What's your read on just what the administration has planned with Iran? They don't seem quite as swaggering and as aggressive as they did in the run-up to the war with Iraq. Have they learned their lesson, or are they going to pursue diplomacy, or do they really want to push forward with some kind of regime change?
I mean, I think this is the summer of diplomacy. I think Rice has a limited amount of time to see if they can get results. And so what they're anticipating is that Iran will provide a counter-proposal to the West, to the offer that the West provided to Larijani, the Iranian National Security Advisor, last month. And so we'll see what happens. And, you know, Iran has sort of some of the same factionalization in its regime, apparently, that we have in Washington. So, you know, people could scuttle diplomacy on their end as well. It's not all a matter of the obstinacy here. But I don't think that, you know, I don't think that the military option or other options are totally off the table in Washington. I think that if diplomacy fails, that before Bush's term is up, that we could see an effort to try to get rid of the sites, the known sites where Iran is working on its nuclear program.
All right, well, thank you for joining us, Laura Rosen. Laura Rosen keeps the War and Peace blog and is the author of a piece in Mother Jones, its July-August issue, on skullduggery in Rome and such around big plans for Iran. Let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back with David Feige.
Hi, I'm Scott Elliott. I'm the director of Three Penny Opera. Come check it out and keep listening to WBAI New York.
Instead of staying home in bed at night behaving,
they want love. They want love. Chasing up the alley with the sentimental craving.
Yeah, I love WBAI.
And this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on the FM dial and WBAI.org on the web. And remember, you can listen to all my shows archived at my website, leftbusinessobserver.com. Look for the radio archive right there on the front page. And it takes me a day or two sometimes to get them up, but got shows going back to about 2002. So check them out, please. And enjoy and tell your friends. Especially if they're not in the New York area and can't hear it live on the radio. And now let's take another musical break and listen to some more Sonic Youth, and then we'll be back.
Shine a light into your soul. City streets are freezing cold. City shadows walk the route when they let the rust out. Place you in my past with other precious toys. But if you're ever feeling low down in the fractured sunshine, I'll help you feel the noise.
Yeah, but if you're ever feeling low down in the fractured sunshine, I'll help you feel the noise. How about that for a loving sentiment from Sonic Youth? That also from their new album, Rather Ripped. And now we're joined in the studio by David Feige, who is a former public defender and author of the book, Indefensible, One Lawyer's Journey into the Inferno of American Justice, just published by Little Brown. And welcome to WBAI and Behind the News, David.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
So if I were Bill O'Reilly...
and I'm glad you're not.
And I sometimes aspire to be. I would say, all right, public defenders, you're all crappy lawyers who couldn't get better jobs anywhere, and that's probably a good thing because your clients are all guilty anyway.
Yes, indeed, that's exactly what you would say, and you'd be dead wrong to do it.
All right, tell me how I'm wrong.
Well, you're wrong on pretty much every score, but then again, I think Bill O'Reilly generally is wrong on almost every score, and if he happens to be listening to WBAI in his spare time, he can take that as a direct challenge.
I kind of doubt that.
I do, too. Look, there's no question that that's the perception, and it's also no question that that perception is wrong. I mean, I'm fond of saying that our reputation, public defenders' reputations are so bad that one of the nice things our clients say to us is, you know, you could be a private lawyer. And at first, you know, you take that and you're like, do you have any idea? You know, I turned down a job at one of the highest paying law firms in the country, you know, and you sort of want to do this like, do you know who I am? Do you have any idea? Do you know? You know, but the reality is when you think about it after a while, and I was a PD for, almost 15 years, for more than a dozen years, you realize that that's an expression of their own sense of disempowerment. That really what clients are saying when they say that is, I can't believe that they would send somebody like you to fight this hard for me. And eventually my response is, instead of being defensive, I just go, really, do you think so? And they go, yeah, you're good. And you just go, well, thanks. I like being your lawyer. They say, yeah, but, you know, you can make the money. And you say, well, but I like representing you. The reality is, you know, we're here in New York, so let me just tell you about my old office, the Bronx Defenders. If you were to scroll through the website and look at the credentials of the people there, you'd be stunned. There is not a soul at my office that couldn't get a job, my old office now, that couldn't get a job at any top-tier New York white shoe firm anywhere. I mean, we're talking about, we once had a guy who had graduated from Harvard undergrad, Yale Law School, clerked for the Second Circuit, didn't get a job in our office. We had another guy who had done all those things and was bilingual. He got the job. So that's not necessarily typical, but it's important to know that it's not atypical either. There are lots of really, really great committed lawyers among the ranks of public defenders, certainly here in New York City and around the country. And
now, is New York different from the rest of the country? Because we heard those stories about, you know, the lawyer in Texas who fell asleep during capital trials.
Yeah, you know what the problem with that is? It's not that it's not true, but here's what's up with that. And Texas in particular should be held to account for this, because the way it works most places in Texas is that the judge assigns the defense lawyer. Now, what's a judge's interest in this? I mean, I hate to dime out the judiciary, but frankly, they deserve diming out on this one, which is they want these cases pled and over with as fast as possible. Every court system is overburdened, and it's understood in a lot of places in Texas. You fight too hard, you don't get another appointment. So in those instances, if you want to make a living, you do the dance, you go along with what they want, and that's horrible. And by the by, that's why we have such crappy reputations, is because there are systems like that. But it's not the public defenders. It's the entire incentive structure. In that instance.
And then what about the other part of the question? All your clients are guilty anyway, so.
Some of them are. And what? You know, let me tell you something. At the end of the day, I have a very different rationale for doing what I did and loving what I did. And by the way, I love pretty much every day of being a public defender. I left, obviously, to write the book, you know. I didn't do that because I was burned out. I did it because, you know, I had an opportunity to write a book, and hey, I made as much money being a writer as I did being a public defender, and I wanted to say a lot of stuff. So I went out, and I left, and I wrote Indefensible. But, a lot of my clients are guilty, but by no means all. And even lots of the guilty ones shouldn't be going to prison. The reality is, at the end of the day, I know them. I know their families. It's their hands I hold. It's their mothers I console. They're the ones who I get to know very, very intimately, and it feels really awful when somebody that you know and like gets hauled off to spend umpteen years in a crappy cage. You know, they slap the handcuffs on. That's horrible. I don't like that. And so guilty or innocent, I didn't like to see my clients go to jail, period. And that's, I don't take refuge in this, like, systems argument. I'm not one of those guys who could do both sides, you know. There are prosecutors who leave the DA's office and they're like, oh, well, now I'm on this side. And it's all a process. I'm not like that. I couldn't spend my life putting people in cages.
Well, yeah, you run into a lot of prosecutors in your career. what motivates them?
Oh, God, they're so different. They're so different from me, I have to tell you, by and large. And let me just say, there are a couple of good ones. They're not all bad. There are a few who are okay. But let me go on my little prosecutor rant, if you'll indulge me.
We've got 20 more minutes, so carry on.
You know, you run into prosecutors at some cocktail party someplace, and you know the thing they always tell you, they're all sort of like jut-jawed and real proud of themselves, and that's all fine, and maybe they should be. And by and large, they'll tell you about how they put some serial rapist in jail or some murderer, or you know, their friends, you know, will always say, oh, he's a prosecutor, but you know, he's not like them. You know, he's really good, and he went after corrupt cops, or he went after this or that. And you know what? By and large, that's true. In year 5, 6, 7, 8, umpteen. But you know how they made their bones? Every single one of them spent their careers basically prosecuting poor African-American kids for crappy cases like possession of marijuana and trespass. You know, if we were to watch Law and Order, you'd think that 80% of the cases in the system were rapes or murders, you know? The reality is there are 600 murders in New York City. There are 300,000 arrests. Those other 299,400... what's happening to them? They're getting prosecuted by all these people who, at the end of the day, all want to talk about their murder case and their murder conviction and their serial rapist and so on and so forth. The reality is they got to sit on top of that stack by ruining an awful lot of lives.
So the more notches they get, the higher they rise in the ranks?
Yeah, pretty much. And talk about perverse incentive structures. We were just a second ago. There's another one for you. You know, there was this, I don't know if you saw the Supreme Court case just a couple of weeks ago. Really interesting. It was about freedom of speech in the workplace. And it seemed like all fine. It got some attention. But here's what was really cool about that. The facts of that case, and people, listeners, might remember one of the parties. It was Ceballos v. Garcetti, or Garcetti v. Ceballos. I don't remember which way it went up. But that Garcetti was Gil Garcetti, the DA of L.A. County. And what Mr. Ceballos did to earn his rebuke and what he used to call freeway therapy, which is when they reassign you to a place way the hell out there, so you got to spend hours in traffic to get there in the hopes that you quit, was he decided that a couple of sheriffs had lied in order to get a search warrant, and he called them out on it. And instead of being heralded as the guy who was, like, upholding the oath to only do justice, instead of saying, way to go, man, way to, you know, way to really, really ensure real procedural justice, way to do all of that, they basically tried to fire him. They demoted him. They docked him. They gave him freeway therapy. And it doesn't take long to realize, and it doesn't take many of those guys to realize, that those are the incentive structures in a prosecutor's office, by and large. You're not rewarded for doing that. You're rewarded for getting convictions and being tough on crime and being a big bad posturer, just like all of them. And I got a problem with that.
Yes.
Well, can you tell?
what about that relationship between the cops and the prosecutors? Is it very close? They cover.
But generally, they work hand in glove. But it's actually the reality is it's kind of interesting. It's fairly fractious from what I've seen. It is actually often a fairly fractious relationship.
Well, there's a difference in social status.
There's that. I think that a lot of times cops see prosecutors as obstructionists. I think, I don't know. The truth of the matter is I'm so removed from their lives and their personal interactions that I'm probably not the best person to opine about it. You know, I have always been a defense lawyer, never been a cop, never been a prosecutor, never wanted to be either. And so my window into that world is pretty narrow.
That's the voice of David Feige, who is the author of the book Indefensible, One Lawyer's Journey into the Inferno of the American Justice, the Inferno of American Justice, just published by Little Brown. So how'd you get into this line of work?
I'm one of those weird guys who I always knew I wanted to be a public defender. Back in college, I was an investigator at the Public Defender Service in D.C., and I had always sort of felt like what I wanted out of life was a job that was both righteous and really interesting, and I'm really, really bad with blood. So trauma surgeon was just completely out. Other one, you know, I thought school teacher was one of them, and then I found public defender, and I was completely smitten. And it was, in many ways, a love affair that's still ongoing. I mean, somebody who reviewed Indefensible said, you know, wrapped in all this grit and these crazy, wild, intense stories and this searing indictment of the system, this is a love story. And to some extent, I thought that was a really interesting criticism, and it wasn't a way I'd ever thought about the book. But it is. In a certain way, this is about why I think being a public defender is the most righteous thing you can do. It's about why defending the defenseless and giving voice to the voiceless is just so unbelievably rewarding, even as you do it in this miserable system where you get slapped down every single day while your clients get crushed under the wheels of the system, and why you get up the next morning and you go back and you ask for more. And the book, in many ways, I think, is really about that, because at the end of the day, it's really great work.
What's the structure in New York City? These are not public employees, right? These are private foundations?
Right. The way it works in New York, and it's different all over, is the city has contracts with various agencies. I was, for a bunch of years, the trial chief of the Bronx Defenders. It was actually called the Bronx Defenders, which is the alternate provider in the Bronx. The biggest contract is with the Legal Aid Society, and Legal Aid has actually 4 out of 5. They don't, I believe, work in Staten Island anymore, though they used to when I started there many, many years ago. And the Legal Aid Society has a contract with the city to provide representation for a bunch of indigent defendants, criminal defendants. And the Bronx Defenders, I think, is now either 12,500 or 15,000 cases a year, which gives you a sense, if we're the alternate provider, of just how vast the system is. Like, we're a bit player in the Bronx, and we do 15,000 cases in a year. So just,
well, 300,000 arrests.
That's right, 300,000 arrests. Yeah, that's the story. 60,000, by the way, marijuana cases. Can you imagine that? 60,000 weed cases
just
in a year.
Just like small possessions?
Oh, yeah, the vast majority. Small, I mean, it's crazy stuff.
And what happens to people who get busted on a small pot charge?
It depends. Almost invariably, the first time through, you get what's called an ACD, an adjournment and contemplation of dismissal. Take heed, all ye weed smokers. By and large, what that means is if you stay out of trouble for a year, there's no fine, no time, no community service. It's basically a promise to the court that you will not get rearrested and not get in trouble. And if that's the case, the case is dismissed, your fingerprints are sealed, and the record's destroyed, and it's like it never happened. So that's your first time out. Bear in mind, lest you think there's no there, that's usually after feeling the steel, getting thrown in the tank, spending the night, going to central booking, getting fingerprinted and mugshotted. I mean, the process of being processed is god-awful. And frankly, is, in my view, more than punishment.
It seems like an insane level of pain and expense for something utterly trivial.
It is. But, you know, welcome to the system. That is the criminal justice system. If we policed, a guy I used to work with used to say this, and I think it's right. If we policed the dorm rooms of Columbia University the way we police the projects of the South Bronx, there'd be a revolt in this city in a week. The mayor's phone would be ringing off the hook with, "Do you know what they did to my kid? Do you have any idea?" And, you know, people wouldn't stand for it. No privileged white folks would ever allow the cops to do to their children what the police do to the children of the poor and disenfranchised in the South Bronx. It is outrageous. So, yeah, I mean, welcome to the system. But the problem is, Doug, it's the cumulative effect. It's not the first weed case. It's not even the fact that your fingerprints are on file. It's that these neighborhoods, these areas are so over-policed that it's the next time you get busted for trespassing, and they say, well, you had a weed case 3 years ago or 6 years ago or 9 years ago or whatever it is. And then what happens is you start building up this history, which will, in very short order, disqualify you from financial aid, make it impossible for you to get a job, and basically condemn you to a life of marginalization. And this is what we inflict on vast swaths of our population.
But politicians love it because it wins them. They win elections.
It does indeed. It shouldn't, but it does. And partly because there's no counter-narrative. There's nobody out there. I mean, it's one of the reasons it's why I called it indefensible. It is about the system, and it's about the cases that nobody ever sees. It's about all of the little cases, these kinds of cases, and why it's important to understand the bigger picture of the system. Because, yeah, there's a lot of showboating.
And the system is really stacked in favor of conviction, isn't it?
Yes. It's stacked in favor of conviction in a million ways and on a bunch of different levels. In the book, I talk about this sort of hypothetical case, and I explain why any one of you, ye listeners who think different, take heed. Every single one of you would plead guilty in a case even when you were innocent. And you do it because the frictional costs of fighting a case are so unbelievably high. And you don't think it at first. You think, oh, well, if I really was innocent, I'd just fight it. And you know what? Yeah, you would. Even if you weren't going to go to jail, yeah, you'd fight it the first day, the second day. And the third day, after you spent 4 hours waiting for your 15 seconds in front of the judge, you might still have your raring to go. And then the fourth and the fifth, and they'd offer you a trespass violation, which your lawyer would comfortably say doesn't give you a record, just one day of community service. And you'd say, I'm not doing a day of community service. And you'd fight for day five, six, seven, until you'd used, half of your vacation time for the year, spending days and days in the Bronx waiting for your case to get done. Your lawyer, who, by the way, decent person trying hard to get it taken care of, is saying reasonably, for them, not for you, look, man, I'm doing everything I can. And he would be to get you a trial, but it's going to be another 6 months, 8 months, a year. And at some point, you're going to throw in the towel. Everybody does. Because when we can only try an infinitesimal percentage of the cases, there has to be a mechanism for making everybody else plead. And that's the frictional cost of the system. We use bail and we use wasted time to grind people down and make them capitulate. That's what happens day in and day out, and that's what's so frustrating.
And I want to underscore that. The plea bargain is really what makes the system function.
Well, the plea bargain,
right?
is an absolutely essential part of this whole thing. Because, again, what are you going to do? You're going to have 60,000 marijuana trials in a year? Impossible. Not going to happen. Nowhere close. You're actually going to have none, by the way. But to put it in perspective, in the Bronx, this is one of my favorite statistics from the book. And by the way, there aren't a lot of statistics in the book, just a couple of numbers. But one of them is that there were about 50,000 misdemeanor arrests. I think this is from 2003, Take a guess at how many jury trials there were on these misdemeanors. Go ahead.
15.
Take a flyer. Okay, you're good. 23. 23 out of 50,000. I mean, that's crazy. So what happened? Once again, what happens to the other ones? Well, it's all this stuff, all this getting ground down, all these quick dispositions, all this in and out, all these non-criminal dispositions, which eventually add up. And, you know, it's really problematic. Really problematic for my clients and for the over-policed communities where the vast majority of these cases come from.
Now we're talking about poor people. If you have money for a good lawyer, how are things different?
If you have money for a lawyer, maybe you'll get a good one. If you don't have money, you still might get a good one,
yeah.
I'd like to say. Because, you know, that is, of course, the traditional perspective is, you know, if you've got money for a good lawyer, you get a good lawyer. The reality is, I'll tell you a funny story. I had a case. I consider myself a reasonably good lawyer. I had a drug case where I filed a really interesting motion. I won't go into it for people. But it was a case of sort of first impression, had a really interesting argument, won the case for the first time, made good law countywide, and my client was like, man, you suck. I'm gonna hire somebody. And he went out, and he called Jacobian Myers. And the lawyer, Jacobian Myers, said, oh, who's your lawyer? And he said, David Feig. And he goes, you're crazy. You don't want me. And by the way, he did. My client did. It was okay with me. I had lots of other clients. I didn't feel bad about it. At some point, you get kind of a thick skin about this. But, you know, so sometimes you pay and you don't get great representation. Sometimes you don't pay and you do get great representation. I think it's basically true that the people who are wealthy enough to opt out of the public defender system do. I think that's just true. And, that, you know, that's okay. It just leaves more time for the people who really need it.
Now, there's a sense, of course, that the higher your income, the more likely you are to be exonerated. Is that, first of all, is that true? And does your social status have some bearing on how you're received by the system?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, God, yeah. It has an enormous amount to do with how you're received by the system. The same kind of arguments that fall on deaf ears for somebody who is poor and African American get an enormous amount of traction from somebody who's white and privileged. And that's too bad. You know, that's just the way it is. Do you get more justice? Not necessarily. I wouldn't say that. I think that the cases in which your lawyer makes a difference are fairly few and far between. The reality is the outcome's going to be fairly similar no matter who you have, unless it's somebody really, really bad or somebody really, really good. The truth of the matter is, in the middle of the bell curve, it's fairly similar. Not in every case. You know, and I've thought about this a lot. Like at the end of a year, how many times have I gotten results for clients that, you know, other people couldn't have gotten? Are there some? Yeah. Are there a lot? Not that many, I would say. You know, it's fairly routinized. If you're good, if you're aggressive, you know, if you're asleep at the switch or at the table, God forbid, yeah, then it's really, really bad.
I'm speaking with David Feige, who is the author of the book Indefensible, One Lawyer's Journey into the Inferno of American Justice, just published by Little Brown. And what about the judges? How do they figure into this? What do you think of them?
Well, what they think of me is not very much right now, because I name them by name in the book, and I used all their real names, and they're not very happy about that. Look, there's some judges who are great. There are a couple up there who I can think of who are just models of judicial propriety. Judge Boyle comes to mind. He's just wonderful. Great, great, great guy. And temperate and thoughtful and patient and compassionate and, you know, everything you'd want in a judge. And then there are the majority of them, frankly, who I don't think are that way, who are intemperate, who are short-fused, who are not necessarily incredibly, incredibly bright, not necessarily devoted to justice, not particularly patient. And most importantly, not particularly courageous. And that's where I fault them most, I think. I mean, my view is, you're a judge. I mean, you get to wear the robe. You get to sit on the dais. You get to make the decisions. Like, you're up there for a reason. You're up there because, collectively, we have this incredible faith in you to do the right thing. And what I find more than anything else is that the judges, most of them, many of them, rule out of fear. They rule out of cowardice.
Well,
they don't.
They're afraid of being in the front of the post.
That is more than anything else what they are terrified of. As a judge once said to me, you know what? Nobody ever got bounced off the bench for setting bail too high. And the truth of the matter is, nobody wound up on the front page of the Post for setting bail too high. It's only when you let people out of jail that you run that risk. And that's awful. But it is deeply animating to them. They rule out of fear. They do the wrong thing because they're afraid of getting chastised. And that is really unfortunate. you know, I would, if I could change any, I would hope that they had, you know, I would give them, what is it in the Cowardly Lion? What does he get to make him courageous? I don't remember. A heart? Is that what it is?
I can't.
I don't even remember. I'm so bad on this. But, you know, that's what I would like.
Whatever
to
it
see.
Is.
Whatever it is, that thing. You know, because I there are a few judges out there, and some of the ones that I admire are the ones who damn the consequences. They do what they think is right. And that I at least admire because it is principled. And that is something that you want in a judge. And far too often, they're just terrified. And, you know, they don't want to end up on the front page of the Post. It's the only way they're going to lose their jobs. And so they rule out of fear all the time.
Judges don't lose their jobs.
They do. You know, there's no life tenure for state judges. There is. And let me tell you what the turning point was for me. Because remember, even if we're talking about federal judges who do have life tenure, I don't know if you remember this, but you remember the Carol Bayless case? This was Judge Harold Barron. It was a whole bunch of years ago. And to me, this was like the turning point in this whole issue, this whole movement. Judge Baer had suppressed a bunch of cocaine from a car trunk in Washington Heights, as I recall. And I remember the defendant's name was Carol Bayless. And by all accounts, a perfectly reasonable suppression decision. And the Post got a hold of it, and they started, you know, shaking that around. And pretty soon there was a whole movement, and, you know, O'Reilly and every other, you know, flap trapper, you know, got involved, and they were condemning him. And pretty soon in Congress, they were talking about impeaching Judge Baer. For what? He couldn't be impeached. That's absurd. But you know what? You don't have to actually get impeached to get the message that this is really, really bad. And the tragedy is, I think a couple of months later, he reversed himself. He said, I'm not suppressing. She went to prison. It was appalling. It was an appalling, in my view, disgraceful display of judicial cowardice, but even worse, of intimidation by the right. And that's just grotesque, and it happens all the time.
There was a story in the Times today, the chief judge of New York State, Judith Kaye, saying the public defender system is broken. What's she talking about?
I think she's talking, I haven't seen the piece. I will, believe me, right when we're off the air, I'll be looking that up. But my guess is she's talking much more about upstate New York than she is down here. The public defender system in New York City is quite robust. There are a lot of really good lawyers. It's not well funded, but it's not, you know, it's not funded like they do in Louisiana either. But upstate, it's much more county by county. It's much more scattershot. There's not a lot of training. There is down here. If you're a young lawyer and you come to the Bronx Defenders, you're going to get really good training. That's not necessarily the case in rural counties upstate. I think we sometimes forget just how rural upstate New York really is.
And poor.
And so I think when she's talking about that, she's most, I would guess, without having seen the piece, my guess is she's mostly talking about some of the shortcomings of the upstate system.
And finally, what's next for you? Are you going back into the public defender business, or are you?
Not right now. I got a couple cases.
A scribbler.
I think I'd like to be a scribbler for a while. I'm having a lot of fun. In certain ways, you know, being a writer is exactly the opposite of being a public defender, in that when you're a public defender, everybody assumes that you're incompetent, no matter how competent you are. And when you're a writer, everybody assumes, no matter how incompetent you are, that you're supremely competent. You know, you call them up, everybody returns your calls. Instead of being treated like the help as you are when you're a public defender, you're treated like, you know, a deity when you're a writer because of the power of the press and the microphone, as you well know.
Yeah, well, the paychecks are not so big unless you really hit it.
Try being a public defender, my friend.
Yeah, okay, well. Too late for me to go to law school. All right, thanks for joining us, David Feige. The book is Indefensible, One Lawyer's Journey into the Inferno of American Justice, just out from Little Brown. That's it for me, Doug Hinwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this from, what is their name? The Long Blondes, a British group. I think five of them are blonde, actually, but that's the joke. As they say on their website, the witty yet disturbing narratives that barely contain guitar lines and drum crashes, like the Slits playing Roxy Music or Donna Summer reciting the collected works of Harold Pinter, the Long Blondes are truly becoming auteurs of the perfect left-field pop song. Well, anyway, it's pretty good stuff, despite the promotional copy. So here's the Long Blondes and Weekend Without Makeup. Till next week. Bye.